Well, it's quite an honor for me to be here, and I would like to I'd like to thank the MAA first for all that the organization does for mathematics, but in particular for allowing me to share with you tonight some of the things that I find really exciting in mathematics. So I'm going to be talking, as the title indicates, about the interaction of mathematics and the computer, but really more broadly about the interaction of mathematics and experimentation. So the computer is, of course, one of the primary ways in which that facilitates the experimentation in mathematics, but not the only way. Computers check conjectures, they make conjectures, they enable discoveries, assist in a proof, and create, by their existence, new problems and drive new areas of mathematical research. So I'm going to give you tonight a panorama of examples of this interaction, some classical ones that you probably already know about from mathematical papers or from popular accounts, and also some new ones that are maybe that have some surprising features. And as the picture illustrates, this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is just my particular preference tonight. A talk with this title could really go on forever, but I won't, don't worry. So before I start giving you this panorama of examples, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my story and how I became more aware of and more interested in this interaction of math and experimentation and math and computers. And this, for me, happened in the field of public key cryptography, which I won't be saying a whole lot about in any detail. If you'd really like to learn about public key cryptography, then I invite you to look at Alice Silverberg's beautiful talk right here at the Carriage House, which is online. You can learn something from that. So I'm going to be pretty sketchy, and I'm going to try to just indicate where I can, where this field and computers intersect, all the many ways in which this intersects. Oh, and ask me about the pictures later if you haven't seen them. Okay, so some questions in cryptography. So, how can I send an encrypted message to a friend? So a friend is someone you meet frequently, you communicate with about other matters. How can you send an encrypted message to someone with whom you communicate on the side about other things? How to send an encrypted message to a stranger? So this is not someone with whom you have any other means of communication with, but you still want to send a message in code so that only the intended recipient can decode. How to determine if an encryption scheme is secure or unbreakable? And finally, how can you get rich or at least make a living in cryptography? And so tonight I have answers to the three of those four questions. Okay, so a simple example, communication, encryption to a friend. So here's an example of what's called a shared secret scheme. This is where you and your friend get together in advance and agree on how you're going to code and decode messages. And the world knows that you're going to use something called the Caesar cipher, which involves basically shifting letters of the alphabet by a certain amount. So think of the letters of the alphabet on a wheel. There's a double wheel of letters. You're just going to sort of rotate the wheel by a fixed amount. So let's say you rotate it by 5 notches, and that means that the letter A is replaced by the letter F, and then B will be replaced by G, and so on. Now, when you get to the end of the alphabet, then you start having to wrap around again so that Y will be replaced by D and Z by E. Now, you can compute this table of what corresponds to what if someone just says, I'm using a Caesar cipher and my shift is 5. And so if I tell you that, then you can decrypt that message that I've just written in code. Well, okay, so if you tell the world that you're using the Caesar cipher and you don't tell them what shift, it's not going to be that hard to uncover to decrypt the message because there's only 26 things to try. So obviously you got to introduce more complexity into the problem, even with a shared secret scheme. And there's lots of ways you could do that. You could decrypt the first letter by one shift and say, then the second one I'm going to use this other shift, and then the third one I'm going to go back, and so forth. And you would use a different shift for a certain number of places. And so there's lots of ways you could introduce more complexity, but the main idea is you still have to tell your friend what scheme you're using so that your friend can then decrypt your message. Have the answer yet? No. Okay. All right. So in public key cryptography, hey, right. Let's see that again. Need new. Well, you can write it down and get it later. The background was a hint. All right. Anyway. Moving right along. Okay, so public key cryptography solves the following problem, which is really hard to wrap your head around if you have never really thought about it before. And the problem is, how can you create secure communication over an insecure channel between two people who have never met or shared a secret before? Now, this happens all the time. This happens every day. It happens when you send your social security number or your credit card number on the internet. It happens without you being aware of it. So let me say a few words about this in a really sort of sketchy way. Let's go to the beginning of the story. So we have our traditional crypto characters, Alice and Bob. And Alice and Bob want to exchange a key, a secret, securely so that they can engage in the encryption, decryption, and nobody else can know what these messages are. And so prior to public key cryptography, the invention or discovery of public key cryptography, Alice and Bob would have to meet in secret in order to do this. And in the mid-70s, Whitfield Diffie asked the question, can we leave out the part where Alice and Bob meet in private to exchange a key? And to leave that out requires a fundamentally new idea. So in the very first paper on public key cryptography by Diffie and Hellman, the sentence that begins the paper is, we stand today on the brink of a revolution in cryptography. Now, the word revolution actually anticipates the mathematical and political impact of this discovery. In the pictures that I showed you at the very beginning of this discussion, there was a T-shirt with a public key encryption algorithm, the RSA algorithm, printed on it. The printing of that algorithm on that T-shirt at that moment in time, early 80s or whatever, turned that T-shirt into a munition and made it something that was not permissible to export under U.S. export law or even to show to a foreign national. So I'm not going to tell you the fascinating story of public key cryptography, though. So there's lots of nice places to read about that. In this paper, Diffie and Hellman invented the concept of a public key crypto system, yet did not give an example of one. They described digital signatures, and they gave an algorithm for a secure public key exchange. So when I say they defined a public key encryption system, what I mean is they described what the necessary ingredients were to create one, and the actual first public creation of a PKC happened a few years later with Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman's discovery. So the first thing you need is a one-way function. Now, a one-way function is something that's easy to compute, but hard to reverse. So it's an input-output machine where, given an input, it's easy, computationally, to get the output. But if you're staring at the output, it's not easy to see what input it came from. So think of the input as the message and the output as the encryption of the message. It should be easy to encrypt, but hard to reverse that process. And then the question you should be asking is, well, if it's so hard, then how does anybody do it? How does anybody manage to decrypt? And that's what has to be built into a one-way function to turn it into something that's usable for public key encryption. And that's the concept of a trap door. Now, a trap door is some extra piece of information that, which kept secret, permits you to reverse this function, to go from the output, the encryption, back to the input. And only the person that knows the trap door can perform that reversal. So that's the idea. This idea of public key encryption is often in the popular literature illustrated by the concept of breaking an egg, right? That's really easy to do. It's really hard to undo. In fact, I think it's probably impossible to undo. I can't think of a trap door for that. So let me illustrate it by something else a little bit like that. Let's say, let's look at broken glass, shattering a glass. Okay, so that's your one-way function. You got a million pieces, a billion pieces of broken glass, and it was easy to do that, but it's really hard to put those pieces back together to a unified whole to see what was written on the glass or something. All right, so yeah, we say it's hard to reverse, but if that glass happened to only shatter into three pieces, then sure, you could probably figure out how to put them back together. So somehow, the number of possibilities, the number of pieces, is what's really important, is what really makes that problem hard. So you have to have a lot of pieces. Now, you might imagine that it would be possible to build some kind of trap door into something like this, this physical realization. It might be possible to make sure that the glass broke in just some way, so that there's some structure there and that there's some symmetry, so that if you knew what you were looking for, you could actually put it back together again. All right, so, but all of this has to happen mathematically. These sort of philosophical ideas really have to be encoded into something that's quite precise. The existence of a PKC was, at that moment in time, an interesting theoretical problem. It didn't really have any practical applications. And in fact, it was only the widespread use of the computer that gave it practical applications. It was the internet that created a large-scale need for public key cryptography. So where the computer intersects this field is in, first of all, creating the need for authentication, for encryption, for digital signatures, and electronic communications and commerce. The computer enables large computations, large search spaces, generates the building blocks of public key encryption systems like random numbers. It provides experimental information in the development of algorithms, and it provides experimental evidence for the security of a given scheme. So how did I get involved in public key encryption? Well, in about 1994, I guess it was, my colleague Jeff Hofstein had been thinking very hard for a couple of years about what turned out to be a really great idea in public key encryption. And he came into my office next door and asked me a question, which I could answer. And so that bit of serendipity led to three of us at Brown working as a team on this public key encryption algorithm, which is called ENTRU. And ENTRU was designed originally to be very efficient. So I indicated earlier that encryption involved manipulating massively large numbers. But ENTRU was designed to manipulate numbers so that it could be run on a really small processor, on an 8-bit processor. It was part of the getting-rich-quick scheme that I alluded to earlier. It was presented for the first time at Crypto 96 in the Rump Session. The Rump Session is this amazing thing where people get up and they have 2 minutes to speak or 4 minutes to speak. The amount of minutes you get to speak is determined in advance by your submission. So you get up there and you got 3 minutes to do this. So it was presented in Crypto 96. The first patent was awarded in 99. Subsequent development of the system and the digital signature scheme were done in close collaboration with Nick Halgrave Graham and William White. And it was started to be commercially developed in 2000, and that development continues to the present time. So I'm inspired to share with you my personal perception of what I think are the several stages of development that efficient means that it's designed to be practical and it's not going to be provably linked to a hard problem. So the several stages of an efficient public key crypto system, at least in terms of the reaction of the crypto and business community. So inspired by one of my favorite television series, I give you the following four stages of the development of this crypto system. Stage one. Nothing interesting is happening here, and the scheme is probably easily broken. Stage two. Well, there might be something interesting happening here, but it's certainly way too early to adopt this scheme for use in application X. Stage three. There's clearly something interesting happening, but we certainly can't use it in application X until it's been standardized. Stage four. It was definitely interesting, but even though it's standardized, it's way too late for us to use it in application X. So the ENTRU encryption scheme is in a very the most interesting stage yet, stage five, where it actually has some close connections to some issues of concern in cryptography, quantum computing and cloud computing. Quantum computers are based on the physics of quantum mechanics. There are significant physical challenges in creating a powerful quantum computer, but there is a proof of principle. Toy models have been created. And lattice-based systems like ENTRU appear to be resistant to quantum-based computing attacks. And in fact, the National Institute of Science of Standards and Technology is currently researching post-quantum algorithms and hopes to make a recommendation. Okay, so let's move on to this panorama of examples that I wanted to tell you about. And I chose three classical examples, which you probably have heard about, but they're classical in the sense that these are questions that came up in the 1800s and were recently, by the geological standards, answered with the help of a computer. So I chose the four color theorem, the Kepler conjecture, and the Riemann hypothesis, and the experimental evidence for the location of the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. So the four color theorem. So this was arguably the first computer-aided proof. Okay, so in 1852, the conjecture was, you have a map Okay, you have to articulate what you mean by a map, so that this is a well-defined mathematical object, but you know, whatever you think of as a map is probably a map. So you have four. So the conjecture was if you have four colors, that suffices to color every single region in the map, no matter how complicated it is, no matter how big it is, so that no two adjacent regions have the same color. That's the conjecture, pretty simple to state. It was not proven to be true until 1976. Appel and Haken gave the first proof. So what they did was a mathematical analysis that reduced the conjecture to verifying what happened in a little over a billion cases. And they could not be done by hand, feasibly. And so they found a computer program that checked these cases individually, and there you have a proof. So the computer enabled a brute force search that was not feasible otherwise. And at the time, right, so at the time this and subsequently, then this engendered a lot of discussion and even argument about the value of and what constitutes a mathematical proof. I mean, are we any more or less certain if a computer checks all these cases than if a mathematician sits down and checks them by hand? So what constitutes a proof? Why do we want to prove anything? Why do we want to prove a theorem? We want to prove it so that we're certain. Can we be certain if a computer does it? The other reason we want a proof is that we learn something from a proof. What can we learn if a computer has to go through all these cases? How do we learn something from a proof? Well, if I tell you that the number square root of 2 is irrational and that there's a proof of that, then you go away with one piece of knowledge. But if I show you the proof that the square root of 2 is irrational, you will immediately go away with more knowledge. You will see, oh, that the square root of 3 and 5 and any prime number is irrational. So you learn something from a proof, but this kind of proof seems to violate both of those things that you want from a proof: the notion of certainty and learning something new. But actually, learning something new in this way should be thought of more broadly and goes the other way in some sense. So later in 2005. Gontier at Microsoft Research and Werner came up with a fully formal computer proof using this software proof assistant developed at INRIA. And he wrote, although this work, so this fully formal computer proof means that the mathematical, it does everything. You know, it's you know, you plug in the four-color conjecture, and by verifying programs and converting all these ideas into data structures, you now have a full computer proof of this, as opposed to somebody doing some mathematical analysis, reducing it to some cases, and then the computer checking the cases. So this problem has been reduced to a combinatorial problem that the computer can fully check. And he wrote, although this work is about using, seems to be about using computer programming to do math, really he expects that most of the fallout will be in the reverse direction, using math to help computer programmers. Okay, the second classical example is the Kepler conjecture. Okay, so what is the Kepler conjecture? It was first stated in 1811. And it states that, so you have a bunch of equally sized spheres in three dimensions. Maybe some of you are thinking, well, what other dimensions are there? But okay, we're in three dimensions, we're putting equally sized spheres in a box. And the question is, how do we cram as many as possible into this box? How do we fill this box with equal-sized spheres so that the density is as high as possible? And the answer is the standard grocery packing of oranges. So imagine the oranges just packed in next to each other, face-centered, and then the next level you put them in and the indentations. That movie was supposed to keep going, but anyway. So that was the conjecture, that was the densest packing of equal-sized spheres in a box, in an enclosed region. In other words, if you threw them in randomly, you're going to get less. And there's no other arrangement that would beat this. So the maximum density, it turns out, is about that. By comparison, a random density is 0.65, meaning, you know, as I said, if you just threw them randomly into a box without any prearranged ordering, that on average you get this density. Now, this problem was solved a long time later, in 1998, by Tom Hales, using an approach suggested earlier. He reduced the problem to minimizing a function of 150 variables, found the maximum, which maximized the density of any possible arrangement, had to implement about 100,000 linear programming problems on the computer, and the submitted article went through a very long, extensive referee process. Now, you might think this is a great thing to have solved, obviously, you know, just from a mathematical point of view. But in fact, it has interesting applications. Sphere packing has applications to biological problems. You know, a sphere packing models a clustering of cells or a clustering of platelets. And the number of cell-to-cell contacts depends on the arrangement of the cells. Obviously, that's affected by the number of cell-to-cell contacts depends on how they're arranged in there. So the knowledge that a random packing has a density of about